when University of Illinois Chancellor Phyllis Wise emailed students to tell them that Monday classes would go on despite sub-zero temperatures, there was pushback online, some of it by way of a rude Twitter hashtag, which soon collected racist and sexist remarks. Stupid college kids blowing off steam are an example of what women in academia often endure online. I'm Jim Meadows, and today on Focus, our guests will talk about incidents where men in academia target women online for their gender. We'll hear from journalist Amanda Hess, U of I anthropology professor Kate Clancy, and Field Museum video blogger Emily Grassley. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Yesterday, University of Illinois Urbana-Campus student body president Demani Bolden issued an apology to Chancellor Phyllis Wise. Not for anything he did, but for hostile tweets that some students aimed at her after she announced class was in session Monday despite frigid temperatures. Bolden issued a statement saying that the student body deeply believed in maintaining an inclusive and pluralistic community, and that the sexist and racist tweets sent with a special hashtag misrepresented those community values. A relatively small number of people sent those tweets, and many were quickly taken down, but they're an example of the sort of target women risk becoming on the Internet just for being women in positions of leadership or in areas of research where they're considered by some to be outsiders. Later on this edition of Focus, I'll talk to two guests who have endured hostile online communications just because of their gender. But right now, let's listen to Amanda Hess. She's a freelance journalist who recently wrote about her own experiences with abuse online for the Pacific Standard. In her piece, Why Women Aren't Welcome on the Internet, she writes about Internet civility as a civil rights issue, describing the extent to which readers have gone over the years to tell her how much they dislike her work. In several instances, she was threatened with rape and murder. She told WILL News and Public Affairs Director Scott Cameron in this pre-recorded interview that even though she's disappointed by the tweet sent by some U of I students on Sunday night, she's not at all surprised.
I think everyone who has any sort of public presence, whether it's just on a social media site or you know, at the head of a large university, has had a similar experience if they are a part of any marginalized community, whether they're a racial minority or, in my case, a woman.
In the case here at the university, it was both. We have a chancellor. This is the top administrator here on campus. She is a woman. She is Asian American. Online being attacked, comparing her to Hitler. One quote said that, and there were vulgarities that I'm not going to repeat here, one quote said, Asians and women aren't responsible for their actions they're putting online. I mean, just very intense personal criticism. And at the end of the day, this is an argument about the weather.
Right. This is an extremely common experience. In my case, the sort of feedback that I get from my stories ranges from, just typical bottom-of-the-barrel sexist insults, sexually explicit commentary on the way I look, what my body looks like, and then, in a few cases, escalating to actually criminal threats of rape and death. And these are criticisms that are ostensibly linked to opinions that I have, but they don't engage with my opinions in any way, and they sort of stifle this discussion, derail my work, and make it a lot more difficult for women, people of color, any sort of sexual minority to have their opinions be just dealt with on the level of the work as opposed to their identities.
As that happens again and again, what is the long-term effect of repeated online attacks against really any woman who steps out and puts herself out there and says, here, I am doing my work, I am living my life online like everybody else, there must be an effect?
I think it has an effect in two ways, and one is on the person who is being attacked. So in my case, and in the case of many women that I spoke with, these sort of attacks, you know, they take a lot of time for us to deal with in terms of reporting them to the police, in terms of, you know, cycling through all of the abuse to find constructive or fair criticism about our work, which is extremely important for us to engage with. And they sort of tell us in ways big and small that we don't, you know, really belong in the public eye, that our opinions are not relevant, not because of what we're saying, but because of who we are. But they also have a wider effect, I think, not just on the targets, but on anyone in their community who is a woman or is a person of color. So in the case of this sort of university-based threats, there's been a lot of, you know, focus on the threats against one person who is a public figure and focusing on how that might affect her. I read that she's someone who does not use Twitter and so hadn't seen the threats personally.
That's
they
right,
also
yeah.
send a message to any sort of non-white, non-male person in the university community that they're not particularly welcome there.
It's an interesting point. The chancellor apparently has now seen the tweets and did comment on them, saying that, you know, this is, they were hurtful and that this is we need to have a conversation about civil discourse and what that means on the campus. The campus is not going to look for any discipline. There's going to be no punitive measures. This is a free speech issue. And so far, that was the only response that we got directly from the chancellor or anybody else here at the university. And there's a president here on campus. There are other top administrators across the campus. As you talk about that kind of a message, what message this sends as this happens, I'm curious of your thoughts on the decision not to discipline, to say this is a free speech issue that we haven't heard from other people at top levels on the campus in response to this. Does that also send a message?
Yeah, I think it's certainly a missed opportunity. You know, in my case and in the case of many female journalists, the only sort of recourse we have for messages that become threatening is the police. And as we've seen in this case, the campus police deemed that the tweets did not rise to the level of a criminal threat, which is probably true. But the disappointing thing in this case is, unlike other women who are working in the public eye or on the internet, these threats, the harassment, are taking place in a community that is extraordinarily well equipped to deal with issues that sort of go beyond the letter of the law. So if you look at the school's code of conduct, for example, all sorts of speech is regulated there, from, you know, anything from disrupting the community by shouting on campus to making sexually explicit comments that rise to the level of harassment. And so the university has not only an opportunity to sort of address this issue as a part of a community, but also really an obligation, particularly in terms of Title IX, to make sure that the community is not one that is harassing or alienating to women on campus. And so I'm disappointed that they have all of these tools that they're apparently deciding not to use.
In thinking, too, about the response and things, so often the message, and again, you have talked about this before, but the message to the victim is, oh, ignore it, get over it, or maybe even worse, you know, see these attacks as some sort of sign of progress, that, hey, you're being noticed online, isn't that great?
Yeah, I've definitely found that to be the case for me. And I think one thing that's difficult is, you know, for example, I am a writer who wrote a story about this topic that was extremely well-read. And so people can look to me and say, you know, these comments don't seem to have held you back in any way. But there are many women that we are simply not hearing from because they are so turned off by this environment that they, you know, they don't even conceive of it as a place where they might succeed. So we really don't know, you know, how many voices we're losing by just accepting this environment that is hostile to women or people of color.
When this happened to you, when you were attacked pretty blatantly online and repeatedly over years, how did you respond?
So this has happened a number of times over the course of my career, and I really had no guidance for how exactly to respond. So I've sort of been testing out different possibilities. In some cases, if it doesn't rise to the level of a criminal threat, so someone saying, I'm going to come to your house and rape you and cut off your head, which has also happened, you know, I tend to just tell friends, so I have a sort of peace of mind that other people know what's going on, and they can sort of help me out if anything escalates. In some cases where I know who the person is, they're doing it under their real name, and it does sort of rise to the level of a criminal threat, I have reported it to the police, even though I know through experience that it doesn't tend to get very many results. Because I also feel that, you know, there are two sort of responses that I get from people when I tell them that this has happened. And one response is, you should just shrug it off. No one's actually going to come to your house and decapitate you, which, you know, the second part of that statement is probably true. And then there are people who say, this is really serious. This person is committing a crime, and you should do everything in your power to put them in jail. So I'm left in sort of this intermediary space where, on the one hand, I don't want to overreact, but on the other, I feel personally responsible for reporting them, and I fear that if something does happen and I haven't reported it, you know, I might be blamed for not taking action. So I don't think there's really an ideal response, but my tactic has been to sort of share the harassment and the abuse with people who I know will be receptive to me talking about it. Share it with the police just to get some sort of paper trail, and then hope for the best.
Yeah, it was. I noticed in the Pacific Standard piece that you wrote that you describe at first when you saw these threats feeling terrified, disoriented, and then it shifted. What came next?
After sort of the initial shock of seeing, you know, a totally anonymous person who you don't know saying, you know, very vile things about you and your body and claiming that they're going to come kill you, I've felt a variety of things. I mean, I did feel sort of embarrassed that I was scared because, you know, I in no way want to take away from all of the you know, violent crimes that police are investigating every day. And then I felt sort of powerless and upset because I knew that these people had found a way to harass me criminally and to get away with it, basically. And then I sort of felt, you know, a responsibility to try to figure out why that is. I guess I was just, as a journalist, sort of curious as to why this is a crime that, you know, was able, sort of empowered to proliferate on the internet. So that's sort of how I tend to investigate sort of social problems that I might come across in my life. And it's been sort of really productive to not just talk about my own story, which is one very small part of it, but to really get a handle on exactly why technology companies or law enforcement officials are ill-equipped to deal with the problem.
You wrote about one woman who faced similar online harassment, Caroline Criado Perez.
Yes.
And it's interesting. I mean, she's an example of somebody who, boy, blasted right back, but she did it with dignity. Can you talk about what happened there?
So she's sort of one of the most recent, very extreme cases of online harassment and threats against women. She is a writer and activist in the UK who started a campaign to put more female faces on British currency, which seems like a fairly benign feminist campaign.
Mm-hmm.
In response, she got, you know, countless, just hundreds, thousands of tweets from people who were threatening to rape her, threatening to kill her, just sort of lobbing extremely vile commentary at her. And she really put a lot of pressure on both law enforcement and Twitter by, you know, retweeting a lot of these threats, sort of enlisting her Twitter followers to take the issue seriously. And she's had some limited success. Scotland Yard arrested several people in connection to the threats, and a couple of them pled guilty to some charges. One was a man, and one, interestingly, was a woman. But I know that she's also felt a lot of effects by not just sort of sweeping it under the rug herself. She's sort of had to deal with a lot of problems with the police in reporting the threats, going back through these thousands of messages to send them to them again, and doing all of this work that, you know, the investigators refused to do themselves. So it hasn't been easy, but it certainly raised the profile of the problem for women around the world.
Yeah, and getting back to, you know, sending that message that this is not okay. You mentioned earlier that, you know, when this happened to you, there was no good guidance. I'm not sure that's changed. I mean, obviously, as you and others come forward and describe the experiences and talk about what you face, but how do you change that? How do you make it more likely that as you enter a system, whether it be law enforcement, in academia, with a tech company, that there are, one, people who will take this seriously and understand what this means, and then also have resources that are available to people who are looking for support and for help with what is clearly an attack?
I think it's a very interesting question. And, you know, what I sort of found in my story was that there is no easy solution for it. So if Twitter could, you know, institute a simple technological fix for this, I have faith that they would do that. But one of the things that I sort of found was most confusing for victims is that there seems to be practically zero communication between law enforcement and technology companies beyond this interaction where sometimes, if pressed, law enforcement will subpoena a technological company. And obviously, you know, particularly in the current climate, technology companies are extremely averse to giving up any consumer data to law enforcement, and that's perfectly understandable.
Mm-hmm.
But one sort of thing that I've seen recently since the story came out is that there has been more engagement from certain, you know, small law enforcement agencies with Twitter. So I saw police officers from Mountain View, California, which is a very small agency. Many of their officers recently joined Twitter and were engaging in a conversation with some of their citizens about the story and about the issue. So if we can sort of, you know, encourage law enforcement or, you know, in this case, school officials to actually have a better understanding of the Internet and to actually live there like we do, then I think that can go a long way in sort of increasing the understanding of the issue.
Yeah. And you also mentioned there's a bit of a shift, it seems, right now, or maybe a potential shift, I should say, that there is the law enforcement and the tech response. There's also a recent push to view this as a civil rights issue.
Yeah. I really leaned very heavily on the work of a University of Maryland law professor named Danielle Citrone, who has really sparked a legal debate, which, you know, in her case is proposing that online harassment of women be viewed as a civil rights issue, just as, you know, women's educational opportunities have been legislated through Title IX. And, you know, other sort of economic opportunities have been legislated through the Civil Rights Act. And, you know, it really sort of would not take necessarily huge changes to the law. There are already sort of legal frameworks that frame online harassment that interfere with your economic opportunity on the basis of race, national origin, or religion as illegal discrimination, but they don't currently extend to gender. And, you know, there are other sort of civil frameworks for taking comments that are currently sort of only framed as in-person comments or even sort of telephone calls and extending them to comments that are made over the Internet. But that's a really slow process. And, you know, like all sort of civil rights legislation, It's going to take many years. It's not going to change overnight. But I think increasingly it's impossible for the law to ignore the internet. And I'm pretty hopeful that that is going to happen.
And that's journalist Amanda Hess, the author of Why Women Aren't Welcome on the Internet, appearing in Pacific Standard Magazine and on their website. She spoke yesterday with WYLL News and Public Affairs Director Scott Cameron. This is Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows, and today we're talking about the abuse women in academic positions face on the Internet, not just the hostility leveled at Chancellor Phyllis Wise for keeping U of I classrooms open in frigid weather on Monday, but hostility women may face for just being female in traditionally male fields of research. With me in the studio is Catherine Clancy, and she is an assistant professor of anthropology at the University of Illinois. She blogs for Scientific American at scientificamerican.com about human behavior, evolutionary medicine, and lady business, and recently wrote about the current plight of women in academia. And on the phone from Chicago, Emily Grassley. She produces a video blog called The Brain Scoop for Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History. You'll find her work on the Brain Scoop channel on YouTube. It's a cheerful feature highlighting the science you can learn about at the Field Museum. But Emily says she's had to deal with some pretty nasty comments based on the fact that she's a woman in a predominantly male STEM science world. Kate and Emily, welcome to Focus.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
And Kate, if I could start with you, you work here on the U of I Urbana campus. That's where we're speaking from right now.
Mm-hmm.
What was your reaction when you saw the news about the tweets that some students had sent out about the chancellor? Is it something that people have been discussing with you over the last couple of days?
It has. What was interesting was that the morning that, you know, we found classes, or the night before when we found classes would not be canceled, but of course parents all over Champaign-Urbana found out their children's classes were canceled, I saw a number of Facebook posts of friends and colleagues who were understandably frustrated with this decision. There's a general university trend, not here, but at the other campuses I've also worked at, that we do not close for almost any reason. And so, you know, again, in particular, the parents I saw were quite upset about this. They managed to do that without making character attacks on Chancellor Wise. They were able to do it in a very thoughtful way that talked about the ways in which we should respect workers. And then I saw the BuzzFeed piece. And the BuzzFeed piece was the one that has been shared quite widely, that collated a lot of these really awful racist, sexist, misogynist tweets towards Chancellor Wise, that created a fake Twitter account about her and a pretty awful hashtag. And I think what was really upsetting was that the people who wanted to actually engage on this question of how do we support workers or not support workers in these really in extreme climate conditions were unable to do that in the face, because they didn't want to side with some horribly sexist and misogynist behavior and were not able to actually have a real conversation.
Okay. I wanted to bring listeners into this conversation as well. What's your take on the state of affairs for women in academia? Is it something about the internet itself that affects how people behave? Or should they just know better? Give us your view. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. The phone number again is 1-800-222-WILL. And besides phone or email, you can send your comments to us on Twitter or Facebook at Focus580. Kate, you had your own story to tell, and you told it on your blog at scientificamerican.com. The official name of the blog, Context and Variation. And recently you wrote about an incident in which you were invited to work on an unidentified interesting project. You just called it cool science thing,
mm-hmm,
in the blog post. But
yes.
And you were invited, but in this strange sort of passive-aggressive way. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. I received an email from a man that I did not know, CC'd, someone who was leading this cool science thing. And it was the person who was CC'd was a prominent female scientist I did know quite well. And in this email, which is on the blog post, he said, you know, this prominent female scientist has said basically that she will not participate in cool science thing unless we improve the lot for women in said cool science thing. Good point. So we're inviting you. So in no way was this a, you know, we've thought about the ways in which your particular contributions or your personal prominence as a scientist might be meaningful for our project. We don't actually really, you know, again, the subtext to me was, we don't really care about women in science, but we certainly care about the appearance of it. So if we can slightly increase our numbers so we can say we had more this year than last year, that will look really good for us, independent of whether we actually care about your contribution.
Well, I'm wondering about that and thinking, you know, hypocritical things like this probably go on more often than we care to think, but people are usually not so transparent about it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm just wondering, is this just an isolated incident in terms of this being a person who didn't know how to make an invitation, or was he just so honked off at having to do it that he had to let you know?
I think it's probably the latter. I think that he knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew that it would probably silence and alienate women, but he also knew that he would fulfill the conditions of what he felt prominent female scientists wanted him to do. I've been contacted by two other women who received the identical email, who recognized it on my blog and said, oh, I also was asked to be a part of Cool Science Thing, and I want you to know that I decided not to be in it because I was really disappointed and offended by what I received. And so it had, frankly, the intended effect that few women took him up on the offer, but he was able to appear like he was making the effort so that prominent female scientists would continue to be involved.
It was more complicated with you because you wrote back and you remarked on the nature of the invitation, but you also tried to be part of the project, and it got complicated after that.
It did. I wrote back and I tried to explain that, you know, an email like that might make actually women feel less welcome and less inclined to participate. And that email, while prominent female scientists responded and said, heck yeah, thanks for doing that, this man never responded. And then when I finally did send in my submission, the very next day, I was told that it wasn't appropriate. And why not send it off to the New York Times? It seems like it's better for a New York Times opinion piece. It was really made clear to me again that they wanted me but didn't want me. It was sort of a sorry, not sorry kind of a situation.
Okay, and that's how it ended up, that you're not part of the Cool Science Thing?
No, eventually I wrote back, prominent female scientist wrote back. We kind of made a bit of a stink, and I got another sorry, not sorry kind of an email from a person even higher up saying, well, seeing as prominent female scientist really pushed for you, and our policy is if anyone pushes for you, we let that person through, we have, and so we shall publish it, so you're in. So it was this, again, a very backhanded kind of a, you're included, but we just want to make it very clear to you that you are included in a way that we are not really comfortable with, and we never really wanted you here to begin with.
The sort of diversity hire sort of thing.
That's certainly how they made it feel. Rather than understanding the contributions that diverse people can make, they instead saw me as a number.
Okay. You, of course, were not quiet about this because you wrote about it on your blog. So even though you didn't name names, mm-hmm. Everybody who reads the blog knows about the situation. I mm-hmm. imagine it circulated a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, the participants know who they are, and some people may have figured out who they are if they know them.
Sure.
What sort of response came out of that? I mean, you're on the internet now. There are comments. What happened?
There were a lot of people who, and this is a place where I imagine Emily can have a contribution too, is there were a lot of people who immediately questioned why I was taking it so seriously and immediately questioned my tone. So there was a lot of what's often called tone policing, where people were saying, well, you know, I think that this was a real genuine attempt of theirs to include you, and I think that you're just taking it wrong, and are you really all that important or prominent anyway? So a lot of Twitter comments that were very negative, saying that, you know, maybe I didn't belong there anyway and I shouldn't be bothered by these kinds of things, and this is what happens when women try to get involved in science.
Did it really come out to something that naked as you know, that direct?
Yes.
As essentially saying women don't, which is a way of saying that women don't belong in science.
Yes.
Well, and if I can weigh in here for a second, too.
Yes,
a
Emily.
Lot of the response that I get, you know, I had a video in which I kind of addressed some of the negative comments that I'd been receiving as well. And people's comments are like, you set yourself up for this. Mm-hmm. Like, you agreed to do this and to endure these comments when you put yourself in this position. If you want people to watch your videos, if you want people to read your blog posts, you just have to toughen up and deal with it. Which was something that I always had a difficult time dealing with, too. And with that, and kind of dealing with and accepting negativity, you also are expected to just accept handouts as if they are handouts, as if, you know, somebody offers to include you in an event and they give you a backhanded compliment, and, well, you better just suck it up because, you know, they didn't have to be so generous. And that kind of passive aggressiveness is what I think deters a lot of people from really wanting to participate honestly. And really contribute their unique voice, you know, for fear that somebody's going to target them or think that they're making a big stink about something if they, you know, question, well, what was that person's intention in inviting me to this event or having me speak about this topic?
Well, exactly. That's something I think also talks about the nature of discourse on the internet, which more and more is our discourse. We talk to each other on the internet. That's something I want to get to after the break. We're in the midpoint of the program, and when we come back, we'll talk more with Kate Clancy and Emily Grassley about women, the academic world, and the online world, and how some guys behave when all three come together. This is Focus on WILL. Welcome back to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're talking about women, academia, the internet, and what happens when these components intersect. My guests right now are University of Illinois anthropology professor Kate Clancy and Emily Grassley, who produces a video blog for the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. As we continue, remember, your comments are welcome at 1-800-222-9455 or email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. We're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus580. The phone number again, 1-800-222-WILL. Emily, I wanted to show listeners, maybe show is not quite the right thing to say in radio, but give them a little sampling of your video blog. You can find it on YouTube under the title The Brain Scoop. And here's a little clip just of a regular edition of the show.
There are many things that plague our country today. Rampant crime, violent video games, a degradation of family values. But perhaps most importantly, children aren't being taught to differentiate properly between horns and antlers. Horns and antlers are generally used for defending territory, fighting off predators, and attracting mates. I know nothing gets me going quite like a nice big rack of antlers.
Antlers!
No, Stefan, that's a horn.
Anyway, I hope that gives you a general idea. It's a little fun little feature, popular science. Some of it's a little gross because, you know, dead animal specimens and things like that, but it is science, and that's one way to hook the 9-year-old boy inside all of us. But, Emily, recently you posted really a different edition of the Brain Scoop, really not talking about the science and the exhibits and the collection at the Field Museum, but instead talking about the creepy, sexist emails you've had to put up with. And I guess, are they emails or are they comments that come in on YouTube?
Can you rephrase that?
You were talking and you quote in this segment of the Brain Scoop called Where My Lady's At, mm-hmm. about some of the comments you get. Are they things that folks email to you, or are they comments that, say, show up on your YouTube page?
There's a variety of ways people can get a hold of me. You know, I have a Tumblr, I have a blog, Twitter, Facebook, inboxes, and YouTube comments. So it's kind of like an aggregate of all the different ways in social media people can get a hold of me.
Well, let's go ahead and play a minute from that video where you quote some of the messages in question.
I feel like in general women don't have enough time to do these things because of the pressure that every episode has to be flawless in execution. This could be a deterrent for both men and women, but I feel like women are going to give up more easily because of comments like this.
I'd still totally do her.
We have a fear of the feedback from our subscribers and commenters because we're afraid that our audience is more focused on our appearance than the quality of our content. Even more than that, we're not convinced that the content has to be good or factual because we're not convinced that people are watching for the content in the first place.
Finally, I've saw her body. Oh my God. How can a woman be hotter than Emily? If you ever need a safe place to stay while you study the Patagonia in Argentina, please, feel free to get in touch with me. I will sponsor your whole journey just to stare at you.
There's a fear of the awkwardness that comes with being on screen with anybody else because some assume that there must be some sort of personal relationship happening, which makes work with that person later on awkward. And on top of that, it makes me feel awkward having somebody on my show because I'm afraid they're going to see those kind of comments.
This is the weirdest lesbian porn I've ever seen.
And again, that's a clip from the edition of The Brain Scoop that you, Emily Grassley, called Where My Lady's At. You really handle it in a witty way, but also you could tell that you weren't kidding. And those messages, those were things that people really sent you.
Yeah, those were comments that I read and then reread, kind of in disbelief.
How, you know, had this something that had been happening all the time with The Brain Scoop, which I understand you started before you came to the Field Museum, or is it something that started coming in more recently?
Well, as an audience expands, you're going to exponentially get more comments, and within those comments, you can expect to probably get more people who are less focused on you as an individual and kind of they feel like there's a barrier between myself and them, as if a comment posted that doesn't directly speak to me and is instead about me, as if I won't read it, or as if, you know, I'm too busy or whatever else. But I had been receiving those comments as soon as I had started making videos on YouTube. It was something that my first appearance on a YouTube video was in December of 2012, and you know, the reaction that I had from Hank Green, who I was in the video with. He produced the video, put it on his show, The Vlog Brothers, and he said, you know, if you're interested in doing online video, do you think you could handle a comment? As if it was something that I kind of had to, like, set myself up for. Like, yeah, you know, the weirdness of having people not only talk to you in great numbers, but talk about you. But I wasn't really prepared for for how I would feel about having so many people comment about my appearance or saying explicit things about me. I don't think there's anything that can prepare somebody for having to deal with that as part of their job.
What made you decide to speak up about it?
Mainly because I had been receiving a lot of emails from young women who were also interested in having their own YouTube channels. They said, you know, I'm interested in botany or I'm interested in history. I'd love to have my own channel like The Brain Scoop. But they saw that I was receiving these kind of comments, and a lot of them were concerned. They're like, how do you deal with those comments? Do you ignore them? Do you hide them? Do you delete them? Do you have somebody else read your comments for you? And their question of how are you dealing with it kind of made me realize, well, I wasn't dealing with it. I was just kind of letting them exist there on the page. And not only did these young women see these comments, but also parents who are showing my videos to their children. And I don't want somebody to grow up in that kind of environment thinking that they'll have to endure sexual harassment in the pursuit of making informative, funny, educational videos.
Now, in the segment, I don't know if you arrived at a conclusion or if you just wanted to get those questions out there about your concern about what this sort of communication means as far as the impact it has on just talking about science in the first place, but having the Internet being a place where women can talk about science.
Yeah, and I don't know that there is a hard and true solution to this problem. I think it's definitely something that not only creators such as myself on YouTube have to address and keep in mind, but also how our audiences participate, how we would like our audiences to participate. And I think it's not something that's going to be solved overnight, but I hadn't really seen it addressed, at least on online video, and especially not in online educational video. So I kind of felt like I needed to get the ball rolling.
You put this out, what, just a few weeks ago?
That video went up in December.
Oh, in December. Okay.
Yeah.
So about a month ago, maybe.
Yeah.
What sort of feedback have you gotten since then about that?
I've received an overwhelmingly positive reaction. I've received hundreds of emails and messages from people, both men and women, who are, you know, some men are apologetic. They're like, they're apologizing on behalf of their entire gender for the way that, you know, men especially have been reacting to my videos. And from women who said that they're inspired by it and they feel empowered that a woman who could, you know, so to speak, have fashion sense as myself, can also be smart and articulate and funny and, oh, wow, what a novelty. But it's been really encouraging, and I think the amount of encouragement that I've received has vastly outweighed the dissenters out there.
And I'm thinking of that in the context of what Kate Clancy, you were telling me with the feedback you were getting, and you were talking a lot about, I hope you were receiving some support and along the way after you wrote in your blog at Scientific American, but you spoke about people who essentially said, well, that's what you have to expect on the internet, and what are you doing here anyway?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in addition to the fact that there are people who question the indignation you may have, or just any feelings that might come up when you have, you know, I've had like Emily, I've had a range of different kinds of harassment occur online in terms of emails, blog posts, Twitter comments, and things like that, and they range from, you know, the drive-by, really gruesome and explicit rape threats, all the way to, you know, a fellow academic writing me a really long mansplainy kind of an email about why it is I'm wrong about something, and you know, all this entire range, all of it has a very chilling effect. And what I think is kind of sad about the times that we're so often advised to not feed the trolls or ignore the people who are being rude to us is that it doesn't actually give us a chance to access all those feelings, vent about what's happening to us, and then have a chance to move on. So what I love about Emily's piece is that by showcasing some of these comments that she's gotten, she's sort of laying bare the experience for so many women online who are harassed. But I think she also takes some of that power back. And so, you know, Emily, I think what you did was really lovely.
Oh, thank you.
We're talking on Focus on WYLL. I'm Jim Meadows. My guests, Kate Clancy, professor of anthropology here at the U of I, and Emily Grassley, who does the Brain Scoop video blog for the Field Museum of Natural History. And you can find it on YouTube. Still time for your feedback at 1-800-222-9455. 1-800-222-WYLL. You can email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Kate, do you see women leaving academia because of this sort of sexism?
I mean,
maybe just internet sexism would be, maybe we're really talking about something larger than just what goes on online.
I think there are a lot of ways in which academia can produce a hostile climate for women. And I do think I have two boxes of tissues in my office. I'll put it that way. And one is for me and one is for my students. And I often do have to close the door and give students space to have their feelings about various things that are happening over the course of writing a dissertation or having classroom conflict or things like that. And I do think that they sometimes the way in which we try to have debates in academia, because it's kind of a masculine way that we engage, it doesn't always give women a chance in terms of the way they've been culturally conditioned to actually access their feelings, try to engage with, you know, content conversations instead of, you know, what ends up turning into character attacks. So it does actually push a lot of women away. And I unfortunately know a number of women who have made it to the PhD and then not gone on to academia, and not because they always wanted to pursue some other track, but because they felt pushed out. And then a number of people who've never finished.
Emily, you're in a different part of the science world. You're in the museum culture. Your job is really talking about this stuff for laymen, for people like me, essentially. I can imagine that, you know, 50 years ago, I would be in the gift shop of the Field Museum and I would have bought a little booklet, say, about fishes of South America. And there would have been color plates, and then there would have been a byline by E. Grassley or something. But instead, this is what you do now. And I'm wondering, do you find those sort of pressures in your work as far as women working in are concerned?
You mean as far as like the women scientists at the Field Museum?
Well, the women scientists are, you know, in your job itself.
Which... You know, it's interesting. I'm coming at this from a unique perspective in that I have a background in art. So when approaching somebody new who's unfamiliar with my work, I'm talking to people and attempting to get them to summarize their last three decades of work in an hour-long interview. So I often wonder if their hesitation to talk with me is because they don't feel I'm competent as a scientist to discuss their work, or if it is because they don't understand or appreciate the culture of web content, or, you know, I'd like to think the fact that I'm a woman has nothing to do with it. But in talking about some of these issues, and especially the Where My Lady's At video, I spoke with some field museum, you know, people, members of the Women in Science group ahead of time, just saying, you know, I'm interested in talking about this. What do you think? And it was a nice, like, good luck with that, kind of like pat on the head, kind of, you know, you're going to be opening a can of worms that, or you think you will, that's actually been opened for decades, and you can try to change something in this new online content media, or, you know, we'll see what happens. I actually, from an outside professional, somebody told me that if you thought that you could change anything, if you thought that, like, the way women are treated in society is going to change, don't you think women generations ahead of you would have done it by now? Mm. And that statement still floors me a little bit, the fact that somebody could just kind of take my fire and try to extinguish it. So I feel like it is an ongoing battle, and it's both men and women who kind of need to come to grips with the fact that things need to change, and maybe things weren't great generations ago, but that doesn't mean that we don't have the chance to change things now.
There's soon to be different levels these things get talked about and in terms of, it sounds like some of the people that are talking to you were talking about the problems women have faced for millennia as compared to the problems women face right now on the internet.
Yeah, and granted, I don't expect those kind of things to change on a worldwide basis overnight, but I do think that the way that we treat women online can be a really great reflection of how women are treated in the workplace, how women scientists and academics are treated. I think we have a good platform to experiment with some of these things.
Okay. We just got an email in from Arthur, and I'm sorry I forget your first name, because you did write you prefer to be anonymous. We won't go any further than that. And he writes, he's been hearing a lot of false equivalents. I think he's talking about other, not here in the broadcast, but the larger discussion of this whole issue, saying that he's heard that other U of I senior staff were also the subject of online abuse, that it comes with the territory, etc. Therefore, what, say, you had to put up with Kate, or what you're putting up with Emily, isn't that special. But he writes, my question is, did the online abuse of those other U of I senior staff include attacks based on race, which in their case would have been their European-American heritage? Or did that online abuse refer to, in their case, male genitalia? No, he answers his own question. So it's really not the same thing. Do you see, do you think some of your critics are guilty of false equivalence?
I'm not sure if I understand the point Arthur is making here.
I think he is trying to defend you by saying that he's heard people essentially answering points made by you and Emily by saying, well, you know, I've had to put up with a lot of junk on the internet too. Mm-hmm. So the fact that you're a woman doesn't really mean anything in that.
Sure. And I think that there are some ways in which I think we all experience harassment, you know, online, and we all experience heated arguments and discussions in the classroom. You know, there are various points in which we all get our feelings hurt. The difference is not just in the volume, but in the way in which it's about people's character. So I think Arthur is making a point here that there's a difference between the kinds of harassment a person of color or a woman may receive online in terms of the absolute volume. So there are a number of Black women academics that I follow on Twitter who, they often retweet the kinds of things that they get. And I have to say, the amount of astoundingly bad racist attacks that they get are just orders of magnitude beyond what I get as a white woman. And so I do think that there are ways in which there's an absolute difference in terms of the volume. And then, yes, it is often about our character. You know, one of my more recent though it was kind of amusing as well. A text that I got was a man who informed me that he had been told by both his wife and his, I think his boss, he said, that he was the epitome of the perfect man, and so was very well suited to tell me how, you know, how dumb I was and how much I was overreacting. So I should just cool it, baby. And, you know, there's just this way where a man would never be told to cool it, baby.
Well, I'm thinking now, and we're going into the last minute. I'm going to give it to Emily if you have something to say here. This is the Internet. It used to be something special to one side that people spent time on. More and more for more and more people, it's how they do their regular daily discourse. And it's a place where you can do discourse like this pretty easily. What do you think this means for the future?
You know, I'm not bitter about it. I'm excited about it. I think we're opening a dialogue, and the fact that we've had so much participation on this dialogue is really encouraging. I mean, the video that I put up went up a couple months ago, and I'm still frequently talking about it. And so I see that as a really good sign, and people are kind of pulling what's going on the Internet, and they are incorporating it in their daily lives and part of their daily business and, you know, part of the online or part of the ongoing dialogue of the climate of our culture, so to speak. So I'm interested in seeing how this develops over the next year, to be honest.
Okay. Well, this isn't the sort of discussion you can wrap up. You can only put it aside for now. I don't think we're going to have any grand conclusions, but I do want to thank my guests, Emily Grassley, who produces the Brain Scoop for the Field Museum in Chicago, and Kate Clancy, assistant professor of anthropology at the U of I. Thank you both for being on the program today, along with Amanda Hess, who spoke at the start of the program here on Focus on WILL.